WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in August of 1837, when two men traveled together by steamer from Pittsburgh to St. Louis. Robert and Montgomery were their names. Their mission was to remove the small islands formed by the Mississippi River near the banks of St. Louis. That would allow a growing city to become a thriving commercial destination, even more so. Their work was slow but remarkably effective, and they grew to become friends that summer. Montgomery was Montgomery Meigs, renowned engineer and eventually the quartermaster general for the Union Army in the American Civil War. Robert was Robert E. Lee, one of the most highly regarded Army leaders who turned down an offer to lead the Union, and, well, you know the rest. Or do you? A new book tells a previously unknown story, at least collected this way, of how the friendship between Meigs and Lee became spoiled by war and eventually turned into revenge. That revenge took the form of Arlington National Cemetery. It's a fascinating and tragic tale told by author Carlo DeVito in the book Mrs. Lee's Rose Garden, the true story of the founding of Arlington. And if you've ever visited Arlington and held your breath in the presence of the Tomb of the Unknown Dead of the Civil War, this book will give you a full understanding of how Arlington came to be, why that tomb was the final form of revenge against the Lee family. Memorial Day is approaching. This is the kind of book that will reawaken your sense of appreciation for the tragedy and sacrifice of war. And my guest for the hour, Carlo DeVito, author of Mrs. Lee's Rose Garden. Carlo, thanks for being here.
Evan, thank you so much for having me.
Also in studio with us is Tim Nealon, chair of the Department of Political Science and History at Nazareth College. Tim, great to have you here as well.
Evan, thanks for having me.
And Joseph Fornieri, director of the Center for Statesmanship, Law, and Liberty at RIT and the author of Abraham Lincoln, Philosopher, Statesman. Joseph, thank you for being here.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you, Evan.
Well, nice to have all of our guests here. And Carlo DeVito, I got to start with you because we're going to dive into this book now. It's a 140 svelte pages here, the kind that you can read before your breakfast on Memorial Day and kind of wake up with a sense of real appreciation of what's going on all around us. It goes back to the Arlington House. I mean, do you remember your first time going there yourself?
Oh, yeah. I was a kid. I was in eighth grade, and I went as part of my sort of graduation from eighth grade, as it were. And we went to Arlington, and it makes an immediate impression on you when you go to Arlington. There's nothing more sort of awe-inspiring. And, you know, from the house to JFK's grave and the unknown's Tomb of the Unknown, it's an overwhelming experience.
And it wasn't always a lock that it would be there. And I want to go back a little bit to the estate and the manor to begin with and how Robert E. Lee came to live there. My guess is most of our listeners wouldn't even have known that Robert E. Lee lived there, that was the house, about three decades there, because of who he married. So take us back to a little bit of the history of that house.
Well, Arlington House was originally set up almost as a sort of home and or museum to George Washington. It was built by George Washington Park Custis, and many of the artifacts from Mount Vernon were actually moved to Arlington. And it sat like an American Acropolis, dominating the skyline of Washington City, as it was then called. And it was a reminder of the great past and the founding father of America. And that's what it was meant to be. And actually, if you had your choice between choosing an invitation to the White House or Arlington House, you chose Arlington House hands down. That's what a destination it was before the Civil War. Politicians, international dignitaries, and especially Army officers all wanted to be at Arlington. And so Robert E. Lee did not grow up in Arlington. He married into that family. He married a very attractive, very bright, and brash young woman, and Mary Custis, and he eventually lived there for about 30 years and took care of that plantation all the way up until the time of the Civil War.
What I love about this book is it gives you just enough of those vignettes and history without getting sort of bogged down in the details, and you get a sense for Mary. She was in demand.
She was the hottest thing going. Yeah. If you went to a party, she had the biggest crowd around her. She was not the most beautiful woman, but she was very smart. She was not intimidated by men in any way, shape, or form, was happy to talk politics and put you down if she thought you were wrong. She was an exceptional painter, and she was an avid gardener. And she traded seeds and plants with numerous people from around the country. And she, her mother, and her daughters were all avid gardeners right up until the time they had to leave Arlington.
We're talking to Carlo DeVito, the author of the new book, Mrs. Lee's Rose Garden, the true story of the founding of Arlington. And Robert E. Lee was interested, smitten with her. He was sending letters and was very clear in his intentions. But Mary's family had to accept that maybe this was not a person of equal nobility. Fair to say?
Oh, no question. She had been courted by numerous people, including Sam Houston, and her parents were had hoped for a much better union. Someone like Sam Houston, in their mind, was a much better match for their daughter. But Robert E. Lee had come from a very good family, although they had fallen on hard times. Harry Whitehorse Lee had been a Revolutionary War hero. He had been severely beaten in a protest against the War of 1812, and eventually had to leave the country and died a rather horrible death. And their family fell into misfortune. And Robert E. Lee grew up in a series of homes that belonged to distant relatives. And so he had a very tough time. He was definitely his mother's son. And he had a very tough life only because after he graduated from West Point, where he was highly respected, never earned a demerit while he was there, graduated number one in his class. His graduation present was he got to go home and nurse his dying mother to her final days, which was a really difficult thing for an only son.
But Mary takes to him, and the family says okay, and they have their union, and they were on the road a lot. They weren't at Arlington all the time by any means in their marriage.
It was a tough marriage, actually, in the beginning, because Robert was an up-and-comer in the Army. He was especially good in the field, but he was also great as a engineer, and Mary was forced to leave home. She was not happy about it. She thought it was going to be exciting at first, but she really did not like living. You know, she had grown up accustomed to much grander living. And, you know, they would live in officers' homes where the floors were dirt. And she would have to be in contact with people who were not as educated as she was. And she had no gardening to speak of. So there were a lot of things that were missing from her life that she had been very accustomed to growing up in some place of privilege like Arlington House.
And yet there's no indication that I have from your book that their marriage was ever really strained enough to be in trouble, that she would have loved to be home, especially in the Rose Garden.
Yes. I mean, at certain points in their marriage, he sent her home because it was the better thing to do, especially when she was going to be having children. She spent much more time at home during those
periods. They had seven children, right?
Yeah, they had quite a few number of children. I think the only thing that I read that he was not crazy about is that she was not a really great housekeeper. Other than that, I don't think they ever had really a bad time of it.
And he meets Montgomery Meigs. They become friends over that summer in 37 where they're working in St. Louis. And even if they weren't the closest of friends, that friendship for Meigs came in handy because Montgomery Meigs becomes the guy behind the erection of the new Capitol.
Yeah, Montgomery Meigs is one of those guys, as we were just saying before we started, you know, if you're not in a Ken Burns special, you're forgotten to history. And Meigs is one of those guys. Meigs was the Robert Moses of Washington back in the 1800s. He not only built the Capitol Dome, but he built numerous buildings before and after the war. He was the longest serving what's the word?
Quartermaster.
In the history of the United States. But more than that, what's really lost to history is that Montgomery Meigs, all throughout the war, was the number two general in the Union Army. And he was really part of a triumvirate that ran the army along with Stanton and Lincoln. And his pushing and prodding of the generals and of Lincoln and Stanton is something that's really lost to history. I mean, this man really helped to manage the war. And when you read about him, you don't understand how this guy kind of fell by the wayside. So an incredibly, incredibly important person. He's a scion of a very wealthy Southern family that establishes itself later in Philadelphia. And he comes from every bit as a prestigious background as Robert and Mary. So these are people who are accustomed to living in better places, dealing with educated people, and having power.
He calls in a favor when he's working on the Capitol, and Carlo's book details that so Montgomery Meigs and Robert E. Lee, as they kind of rose to their own prominences, Robert E. Lee became a very important person, and Montgomery Meigs had a bit of a personality clash as the Capitol was going up, and he needed someone to come in and help, and he calls Robert E. Lee, and Robert E. Lee comes in and essentially gives him the space he needs to get it done. So he cashed in those chips on the friendship. Who knew they were just a few years away from loathing that really turned when the war began?
Yeah, you know, it all comes down to, you know, the as we all discussed, the it all comes down with Lee when he has to make his final decision. He's a hero of the Mexican War. Winfield Scott is the head of the U.S. Army, and there's no question in Scott's mind that Robert E. Lee would be the next commander of the Union Army. I have to say, if you look back on history and think that if Winfield Scott had given the reins over even 6 months earlier, history might have been completely
different. Robert E. Lee would have taken it?
Yeah, probably. Absolutely.
And because he loved Winfield Scott.
He loved Winfield Scott, and it never occurred to him that he wouldn't fight for the Union. It was not even something that he considered up until the time of secession. And one has to take into account that when Lee has to take this into mind, Lee is part of, what you would call Virginia aristocracy. I mean, he's related to at least a dozen and a half, maybe two dozen estates of the largest estates in all of Virginia. And for someone to say, here, we need you to take cannon and go take pot shots at your relatives, your blood relatives, let alone friends, is more overwhelming than he can fathom. And so he actually wants to resign and not fight for either army. And Winfield Scott just totally blasts him and says, you can't sit on the sidelines. You're going to have to pick one or the other. It's a very, very difficult time. And in that moment when he chooses to take the other road, he's not even rewarded originally with the command of the Union of the Confederate troops. He's made a commander in the Virginia militia, but he's not given any serious command until actually after Bull Run, which is runs its course, and Jefferson Davis really loathes P.T. Beauregard, and it's kind of a sort of failsafe there.
But by the way, the fork in history, if Lee was elevated sooner in the Confederacy, would that have gone differently?
Possibly. So, but anyway, when he decides to go with the Confederacy, that kind of seals his fate with people like Montgomery Meigs. Meigs is absolutely apoplectic that Lee, who has lived his entire life through the benefits of the government, would turn his back on the government when it needs him most. And for Meigs, who has a very puritanical background, this is heresy as in the worst form, as far as he can figure.
And we're going to get to the fact that if that wasn't enough for Montgomery Meigs, watching a longtime friend turn his back on the Union, there's a tragedy coming that we're going to get to in a moment that cements. Meigs is almost his need for revenge in some way. But before we even get there, Carlo's book does not adjudicate Robert E. Lee's views on slavery. And in our second half hour, I want to talk to the professors in the studio about the way that sometimes through history we simplify, we kind of cartoonize people, whether it's Lincoln or Robert E. Lee or whoever else. I asked on Twitter this morning, you hear Robert E. Lee, what do you think? And I went through my mentions and I saw traitor a lot, those kind of things, disloyal. And what you find is that history is often a little more layered and complex. Carlo's book doesn't adjudicate Robert E. Lee on slavery, but it does touch on the fact that he pretty clearly didn't like the institution, even if he did express his view that he thought slaves were better here than in Africa. And he also decided, he had made a big decision, I think, after Mary's dad dies and Robert E. Lee has to decide what he's going to do with Arlington Estate. There's 200 slaves, and he doesn't free them. And why, Carlo? Why not free them?
Well, it's a very tough question for Lee because emancipation is supposed to be automatic on the death of George Washington Parke Custis.
Right.
But what happens is that Custis was a great storyteller, a great raconteur, and a you know, a bit of a fabricator, but he was a great entertainer. But he was not someone who was very good at running his estates. And he had run the family fortune really pretty much into the red. And Lee, upon really figuring out how badly off Arlington and several of the other accompanying estates were, went to the courts and said he needed anywhere from 3 to 5 years to set the family's fortunes back in order before he could free those slaves. And so he wins a stay in court. He knows this is a really difficult thing. And the problem that arises is that the slaves of Arlington know they're supposed to be emancipated. And they had fallen into a lot of what Lee termed bad habits, because in the last years of Park Custis's life, he really wasn't pushing anybody. A lot of farms lay fallow, they weren't producing, etc. And so not only had they, you know, developed bad habits and didn't want to work, but here he was saying, no, I need you to work so that we can right the ship. And they said, hey, look, we're not even supposed to be here. We're not doing this. And so that led to a real test of wills. And I think Lee did a lot of things in that instance that he wasn't really proud of.
When people look at Lee again, there's a lot of discussion on, well, Robert E. Lee led the Confederacy, and therefore he defended slavery.
He eventually did free them. And so during the course of the war, he signed the papers for their emancipation, as he had promised in his notes to the court. Many of them were already behind enemy lines at that point, but he did live up to that portion of the conversation. It was a difficult thing for him, because Park Custis had left the estate in a complete financial shambles.
Joseph Fornieri is a professor at RIT, and he is the director of the Center for Statesmanship, Law, and Liberty. And again, Joe, in our second half hour, we're going to kind of delve into a little bit more of the legacy and meanings here, but I know you wanted to weigh in on what you were just hearing. Thoughts on Robert E. Lee and the question of legacy, and do we oversimplify something? It's the same kind of conversation you and I had about Lincoln a couple of weeks ago. The whole notion of, well, Lincoln was pro-emancipation the whole time, as opposed to pro-saving the Union, et cetera. Is there a danger in oversimplifying?
I think we do oversimplify if we look at things at face value without further detail or critical assessment. But I think we inevitably have to, we can't prescind from a moral judgment. Lee is a compelling character. There's no doubt in my mind that he was among the more reluctant secessionists. He describes secession as anarchy. We see this divided loyalty. He says on the eve of secession, or the eve of Virginia leaving the Union, that I foresee the country will have to pass through a terrible ordeal, a necessary expiation, perhaps, for our national sins. And one wonders if he's talking about slavery or if he's talking about other sins. McPherson quotes that in his famous book, Battle Cry Freedom, as do a lot of historians. So I think we can appreciate this divided conscience that Lee had, but ultimately he made the wrong decision. He was on the wrong side, and ironically, his greatness prolonged the suffering and the servitude of millions. He had sworn an oath to the Union, and I think that he broke that oath. I appreciate that. I think at that time his loyalty was primarily to Virginia, and there was this crisis of loyalty for many. You know, I can't raise my hand against my birthplace, he said, but he recognized the problem of secession, and I think he did. I think he did foresee the ordeal that would ensue from this. So I wish he would have remained in the Union.
I know, and here's what I have such a hard time with. The more I read, whether it's Carlo's book or more on Robert E. Lee from other sources, yeah, he is a much different character than just the leader of the Confederacy, traitor, etc.
He's more complex.
Everything leading up to that decision would have led me to believe that he would have said, boy, it hurts me to turn my back on Virginia if Virginia is seceding, but I am more loyal to my union. I still don't understand the decision. And this was not someone who was a hardcore slavery defender, wasn't living in the Deep South, and I still to this day don't understand.
Well, his mentor, as you mentioned, Winfield Scott was a Virginian. So was George Thomas from Virginia, and he was crucial to the Union's military fortunes. George Thomas.
This is part of why I wanted Joseph Fornieri here again, the director of the Center for Statesmanship, Law, and Liberty at RIT, because Tim Nealon. Sometimes we get bogged down in academic arguments, but Joe is saying we can render a judgment that Lee was complex, but he was wrong.
Well, I think, you know, history dictates that he chose the wrong side. And I would say that I think the other thing is, you know, everyone downplays his ambition. He was ambitious. He was absolutely ambitious. And that ambition was realized probably fully in this Confederate fight. He lived in the shadow of his father, Light Horse Harry Lee, who abandons him at age 6 and then goes and lives in the West Indies. And his father was dissipative, and he was a womanizer. It's everything that Lee tried not to be. And so there's a psychodynamic in this guy's makeup. And I think, you know, you look at somebody like Jefferson who could write these great words about liberty and then, of course, also a slave owner. I mean, that is the hypocrisy of being American. I mean, we live in a great country, but we also have great wealth inequities, and you know, we get up every day and we do our thing and we make choices, right? But we don't necessarily live with the consequences. So I think Lee fits in. I think he's very American, very flawed. And I think he was too almost deified by agents of the Lost Cause after the war, because he was not head of the Confederacy. That was Jeff Davis.
And I think that, as my colleague says, I think that needs to be taken into consideration, that the deification of Lee and the whole Lost Cause that completely abstracts from the slavery question or what the war was about and tries to just understand the war simply as a battle over states' rights that in which slavery is incidental, whereas I states' rights, yes, in defense of slavery.
Or, you know, we can look at the progressive historians who said it was, you know, capitalists versus agrarians, right? So, I mean, this is, No, but I'm sure you want to get back to the story of Arlington.
This is why I wanted our academic friends in here, though, because I think there's so much interesting stuff here in just a svelte 140-page book that you can read in less than 3 hours. It's called Mrs. Lee's Rose Garden, The True Story of the Founding of Arlington. Author Carlo DeVito is here in studio. And so here we are. He's made his choice, and he knew, Carlo, almost immediately. He's making his choice. He's got to leave Arlington, and he's telling Mary in letters, you've got to get out of there.
Yeah, Mary really holds on to the last. I mean, what's really fascinating is that even after Robert leaves the U.S. Army, he's off with the Virginia militia, there are the War Department is sending soldiers over to say to Mary, you're going to have to get out of here. These Arlington Heights are way too valuable. It's the first thing they're going to take. It doesn't matter how many lives it's going to cost. They're going to take it. And the Confederacy is not willing to defend the spot anyway. It's just it's too small a piece of ground. Although, as anyone knew, from Arlington Heights with a decent artillery, you could destroy Washington City in an afternoon. But the Union was not about to let that happen. And they were literally sending over people that the Lees knew to say to Mary, please get out. We don't want to see you hurt. We don't want to take you prisoner. Please leave. And so there was that kind of cordiality that was going on. And, of course, back then everybody thought it was going to last about 6-8 weeks. Nobody really thought it was going to last a very long time. She waited to the very, very end. And she was packing away certain things. They buried certain things. A lot of Washington's papers actually got lost during the Civil War. They packed them in lead cases and left them in the gardens, thinking they would be there a summer. It was no big deal, but it's 5 summers and winters, and a lot of the papers were completely destroyed.
That, to me, Carlo, was such a fascinating part of the book, is hearing Mary holding out, wanting to stay at this estate, wanting to stay, and finally knows, got to get out of here. And she takes some of her own items, but then she's packing George Washington's papers and putting them in the basement and locking other things in the attic. Some absolutely, to me at least, historically vital pieces, hoping they would be okay.
It's fascinating because you can go to see all those really fabulous pieces at the Smithsonian. You can't find them at Arlington House, and you won't see them at Mount Vernon. During the course of the war, a lot of the stuff that she left there was absconded with. Some of it was stolen outright by the soldiers that were going in and out of the mansion, and the rest was sent over to the U.S. Patent Office. And people during the war could literally go see George Washington's belongings at the U.S. Patent Office. And the Lee family never got any of that back, and it was rightfully theirs. It was taken by the government, and it was never returned. But it was rightfully the Lee family's property.
Absolutely. And so here we are now. The Union takes up some residence there. They were enjoying some time there. The Union soldiers, a general with a French name. What was his? So he's hanging out with the Union soldiers.
There's a picture of him in the book
somewhere. There's plenty of pictures you'll find of them enjoying their time in this palatial setting. But then as the war progresses, of course, as Carlos said, maybe they thought it'd be over in 6 to 8 weeks. It obviously wasn't. Now we're seeing thousands of war dead. There are questions on what to do about National Cemetery burial of both Union soldiers, Confederate soldiers, and freedmen. Mary is holding out hope that she's eventually going back. She wants her rose garden. She wants to go back to her flowers. And Montgomery Meigs decides eventually that, well, what better way to stick it to a traitor and his family than by burying the war dead that he viewed Robert E. Lee in many ways responsible for on their grounds? And that's how it started, huh?
Right. It's a very personal vendetta. There are a number of Meigs apologists out there who will say, oh, no, that wasn't the intent. It was absolutely the intent right from the very get-go. Lincoln had said during the course of the war that he was not going to be prosecuting these traitors. And to Stanton and Meigs, this was just heresy. How could you not hang these guys, kill them, shoot them, do something? These people had led treason against the United States. And so it's a personal cause. And when Lee sends an agent to pay in U.S. dollars the taxes on Arlington, the lawyer is refused, saying, no, Mr. Lee or Mrs. Lee will have to pay the fee in person, which was complete utter nonsense. But they use that as a ruse. Arlington is then put up for auction because of non-payment of taxes. And eventually the federal government, Meigs, engineers the purchase of Arlington with the absolute intent of turning it into a national cemetery.
And if you had any doubt about Meigs' intent, he went to visit himself and he was upset on the first pass to find out that the initial graves were too far away from the house.
Right. The first guy buried is Chrisman, and they bury him, you know, it's like 1,000 acres, something like that. And they bury him all the way in the back. And that, one of the big problems is, and this is where you have to sort of love Meigs as a character. He comes in and they've buried the first men all the way in the back of the property because the officers who are headquartered at Arlington House don't want all these dead bodies near the house. They don't want to live like that.
They're having some good times.
They're having
there.
Some
they
good times
look
living in the big mansion, you know. So the first things Meigs does is have the entire staff relocated somewhere else.
We will bring in Union soldiers who will do the job.
They don't even do that. He brings in two chaplains, a grave digger, and that's all there is going to live at Arlington. And so he finds 26 bodies, and he has them buried about 100 feet from the front door of the house. And this is the beginning of Meigs's real revenge. And that is absolutely his intent from the word go. He does not want Lee and his family to ever be able to move back to Arlington. This must be his punishment.
Carlo's book, Mrs. Lee's Rose Garden, uncovers letters that were written many by Mary, who still, even with that going on, knew of it, was crestfallen over the use of the property as a cemetery, but still somehow thought, I could get back there, we could restore the rose garden, the flower, still held out that hope. And what I think in many ways cemented the fact that that would never happen was when Montgomery Meigs' son, John, who ends up serving the Union and serving very capably, even if he was a sort of a recalcitrant young student, he became, fair to say, Carlo, a very highly regarded
he's at the First Battle of Antietam as still while he's a student. He's a whole bunch of West Pointers come down for the battle. And during the absolute chaos of the second half of the battle, when Beauregard counterattacks after Stonewall Jackson holds out in the middle, it's Meigs' son who actually forms a line and is able to cover what is utter chaos. I mean, you've got an army that's literally running away, and you've got people who came out to watch the battle in carriages with champagne and picnic baskets, and they're choking the roads, and it's Meigs, who's this kid, who's not even a lieutenant yet, hasn't been commissioned yet, and he sets up a line and is able to cover a portion of the retreat. He gets incredibly high recommendations for his actions at the battle. He does go back to West Point to graduate, and then becomes a premier map maker. He works for Sheridan in the Shenandoah Valley, and becomes quite the map maker. And he's also very good at reconnaissance. He's a very he really is into daring do. He wants to succeed. He's very much like, actually the funny thing that I found about him is that he is very much like Lee was in the Mexican War. He's willing to go behind enemy lines. He's willing to do what they need to do to find the ways to make inroads, etc. He's just living life right on the edge, and that's kind of where he meets his demise.
Yeah, let's not give away every inch of the book, and you can read in the book about how, the sad demise, and then some of the disputed estimation of how he died. But he was killed, shot in the head and the heart, and Montgomery Meigs finds out his son has died. And for Montgomery Meigs, it was enough that Robert E. Lee had turned his back on the Union, but now it feels like there's blood on the hands. And Montgomery Meigs is the one who decided that the Tomb of the Unknown Civil War Dead would go just a few paces from Mary's Rose Garden?
Yes. So what happens is, actually, it gets back to Meigs. The Lees are very well connected and very well liked. I mean, you have to remember that these are people who are really loved throughout the area. And so relatives are walking through Arlington saying, well, you know, if you relocate a few of these graves and you sell off the back piece of the property, you can move back here. And somehow this gets back to Meigs, because it's all, again, a very small internecine group of people. And Meigs is furious that the concept of the Lees returning. So he has to play this sort of final chess move to ensure that the Lees will never be able to come back. So during the course of the end of the war, he has people scour the battlefields in and around Washington and as far away as Maryland, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and other places. And they dig up all the unknown dead. And they place the bones of 2,000 men in a 20-by-20 pit, and then place a giant marble sarcophagus right over it, and it's basically about 150 feet from the house. And this is Meigs' final masterstroke to ensure that the Lees would never be able to return home again. And that's really, and it's such an irony. I mean, that's the sort of Greek tragedy of this whole thing. I mean, A, it's pitting friends against one another. Now you've got this massive tomb set up in somebody's home. It's really just it's an amazing story.
612 acres officially at Arlington National Cemetery. More than 400,000 service members and their dependents have graves there, for more than 200,000 currently buried. About 6,900 burials per year, two presidents there, 4 million annual visitors, and this is the inside story of why it is there. So let's do this. Let's get a short break. Jim in Rochester has been waiting to join the conversation. We'll get to you. If our listeners want to weigh in with what they're hearing here or your thoughts on going to Arlington, your recollections there, the way it moved you. We've got Memorial Day coming up, and I thought Carlo's book is perfectly timed. It's called Mrs. Lee's Rose Garden, The True Story of the Founding of Arlington. It's 140 pages. You could read it in the morning, maybe Memorial Day morning, as you think about the day and think about what it means to this country. And then you think about the tragic circumstances in which it was founded. Amazing stuff. Short break, your phone calls, and more conversation with our panel next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, we'll talk about the latest in climate change. NASA has put out some dire warnings about the melting of an ice sheet. They say it's melting faster than expected. We'll talk about what the possible impacts are and what a lot of people who are involved in this issue locally are already doing to try to get out ahead of climate change. That discussion Wednesday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Clark Meadows at Ferris Hills in Canandaigua, a senior living community offering enriched living with three prepared meals daily as well as medication monitoring. Learn more about tours and residency options online at clarkmeadows.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, author Carlo DeVito in studio, along with Tim Nealon, chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Nazareth College, and Joseph Fornieri, director of the Center for Statesmanship, Law, and Liberty at RIT. You might recall just a couple of weeks ago, I had a chance to talk to Mr. Fornieri about his book, Abraham Lincoln, Philosopher-Statesman, on the 150th anniversary of the assassination of Lincoln. Let's grab our first phone call. It's Jim in Rochester. Go ahead, Jim.
Good afternoon. Very interesting conversation. I want to raise a question. I would like to hear your guest talk about Robert E. Lee. And the reason I said that, we have to remember he went to the United States Military Academy. That's West Point. He took an oath and a pledge to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. But he made war against the Constitution. Now, none of the other generals have done that. Matthew Clark, Dwight Eisenhower, George Patton, a host of Swarkoff, the general that won the first Gulf War. None of those guys made war against the Constitution. And I can take you to downtown Richmond, Virginia, and in a sense they're still fighting the Civil War because there's something down there called Monument Row where they glorify and honor all the Southern generals. And even though they wanted to secede from the Union of the United States, so we got a dichotomy here and something's out of balance. So I'd like to hear you comment on that.
Well, that's a great point, and again, I think that's the legacy of Robert E. Lee. One of the things that's happened is at least since Alan Nolan's book back in the 90s, there has been a revision of Lee. It's still very difficult to get anybody to have a real serious conversation about this betrayal of his oath of office. Not only did he attend West Point, but he actually was in charge of West Point at one point. He was a career serviceman in the United States military. His decision to leave obviously freighted with all sorts of wonderful quotes and angst. But on the other hand, he made the decision to leave. He made the decision to join forces with the Confederate States. And I think you cannot untie that from his feelings about African Americans. He had all of the prejudices of that time, his hypocrisy on slavery. He was willing to continue it as long as there was an economic advantage for him.
Didn't trust them with the vote. Is that Joseph Fornieri during Reconstruction? Is that right?
Yes, that's right. That's right. He opposed conferring suffrage upon African Americans at the end of the or during Reconstruction period.
Testified to Congress in 1866. They called him in and he said, not only not the vote, but you know, somebody asked him, so if you could take all the African Americans out of Virginia and send them further south, would you? He said, absolutely. This is a guy who, I mean, again, all the prejudices of his time.
Agreed, 100%.
Just a little, yeah.
But Stephen Brighton thinks the conversation's been tilted toward the Union. Steve, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Having lived here 30 years, I wonder how this show would go if you were being broadcast in the South.
I would love for this show to be broadcast in the South. But go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that, too. Well, you can't take away the fact that people are products of their time, whether he was prejudiced or not. We're very proud of Robert E. Lee. He was a gentleman. He was a great general. And we're proud of him, despite how it ended. And to say that he chose the wrong side, that's you speaking for him. Do you think today that he would say that he chose the wrong side? I'm not sure.
I hope he would be wise enough to, because he did choose the wrong side.
Yeah. Well, he chose the side that lost. But perhaps his heart was on the, you know, he had to be with his heart. So what does the wrong side really mean?
This is not.
I'm going to leave you with that. I love your show, okay?
Yeah. No, Steve, well, listen, first of all, Steve, I want to say it actually takes some courage to call in and say so. And I appreciate that. And we're going to have to disagree on certain things here. I don't think it's complicated. And it is not about winning and losing. He didn't choose the wrong side because eventually the Union won and the Union was preserved. Had the Confederacy won that war, and if we had two countries right now, Robert E. Lee, in my view, would have chosen the wrong side. And I don't know that that is all that controversial today, but maybe it is. And I appreciate Carlo DeVito. You've studied the man. Steve says product of his time in many ways and admired in the South.
I agree that he was a product of his time. There's no question about it. And he had all the prejudices of the period and of the region. I think one of the things that's that makes Lee that much more complicated is, one, he's a brilliant general. He takes massively crazy chances and pulls off one unbelievable victory after another.
Was there any general better than him?
Well, I mean, you know, Shelby Foote said, look, you could argue, but, you know, Grant eventually beat him. So that was really all there was to it. You know, they kept searching until they could find one guy who could beat him, and Grant was that guy. And Grant had just had a different way of fighting. But the thing about Lee that's really fascinating is that after the war, Lee is someone who is both used and who volunteers to try to get the Confederate veterans to go back into the Union and to convince them to beat their swords into plowshares.
That's right.
He's a very, very pivotal person in that way. So he, you know, he is seen as a father by a lot of those soldiers, and in that, as the war ended, he acted incredibly responsibly in trying to lead those men back into the Union peacefully. And that's another part that complicates his legacy in a big way.
But Johnson's pardon, which came out initially in 65, summer of 65, did not cover Robert E. Lee.
Did not.
And so Robert E. Lee had to be very circumspect, because until 1868, on his way out, when Johnson's going to give a more specific pardon for people like Lee, he could have been tried for treason. And there were a lot of Yankees, Steve, who wanted that to happen, because he did take up arms against the United States government.
Absolutely.
And he did it thoroughly. And as for generalship, look, he faced some pretty weak Union generals. Let's just be honest there. And number two, you know, his great invasions of Maryland, Antietam, Sharpsburg, depending on where you live, or Gettysburg, ask Pickett how he felt about General Lee's generalship, because he didn't respect it. And Longstreet, poor Black Pete, he tried to make some statements, and instead they decided to give him scapegoat.
Yeah.
So again, as a historian, I'm a little more nuanced about this, and I get very uncomfortable. I do understand, Steve, that the victors write the history. But in an interesting way, Lee's history has been glorified since almost the beginning of the Lost Cause movement in the 1870s and 80s. And only in the 1990s, I think, have we taken a more, you know, look at this more specifically at what he could have done. I mean, he was not bound to serve Virginia.
No.
Winfield Scott didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the first caller, and I, you know, made clear that we can't evade judgment. But at the same time, I think we'd all do well to follow Lincoln's advice during the second inaugural, with malice towards none, with charity for all. And, you know, well, one could, if pressed, makes those difficult choices in a complex situation, recognizing that Lee did have a great sense of honor, despite the tragic mistake that was made to prolong the war and prolong servitude. This was not Nathan Bedford Forrest, right? I mean, this is a person of a very different character.
Right.
And this is someone who discouraged at the end of the war a guerrilla war.
Right.
And I think was more sober in that regard than Jefferson Davis, who was prepared, you know, to spill all of the South's blood before conceding. You know, I think Meigs's behavior, I think in this regard is that danger of that, the vindictive self righteousness.
Well, yes, he was aligned with the radicals of the Congress,
right, I mean,
and with Stanton, and they were really looking. They wanted blood, and you know, it's actually very sort of sad when you look back in history. The only man who really truly paid a price for his actions was Jefferson Davis, who lived in a very small in a cell. I mean, he could have paid a bigger price with his life or his head, but I mean, he was the only one who was really made to suffer. A lot of the other guys got off scot-free. free in a lot of ways.
But his admirers gave him Belvoir, and he did really well at
afterwards,
the end.
Yeah.
You know, so
I
have a
question for my colleagues here in terms of the military history, and you had mentioned Gettysburg and Pickett's charge.
Biggest blunder of the war, to be honest.
Yeah. But it wasn't, you know, how do you account for that, right? I mean, Lee was a brilliant strategist. I think that it was, you know, from my reading of it, that he didn't have the proper intelligence and thought that didn't understand that the Union forces were so strong.
Oh, I don't know.
Didn't have the proper intelligence as in information.
Yeah.
Longstreet, though, was pretty adamant, saying, we do not want to make this charge. This is not a good idea. We've been on the other side of this charge.
Yeah.
This is not a good idea. And the thing was, Longstreet was right all along. They should have pulled south of Gettysburg instead of fighting the fight where the Union generals had been able to gain the upper hand in terms of getting the better ground. If they had pulled back south of Gettysburg, now the Union Army has to attack as opposed to sitting on its heels and repel an attack. The odds are always with the defender in these battles. And I think Lee would have had a much better chance sitting there because now he's got Washington right in front of him. Yeah. So he's like, come and get me. Come and get me, because if you come and get me, I got you. But he decides for whatever reason that he is going to try. And if you've ever been there, you sit there with madness.
It seems madness.
These guys have an entire ridge, and he's going to try to go up
uphill,
that ridge.
Now,
I mean, the first day, too, you have to remember, too, that the first 2 days, they come damn near close of turning the flanks on these on both sides of this ridge, and Lee's feeling is they've bunched up on the ends. We can take a clear shot at the middle, but it was obviously
that. But that's the whole point. I mean, he was very, you know, you're talking about taking, and what you said, I think you said, Carlos, insane risks. I mean, really. I mean, Jeff Davis had an idea how to win this war, which was, you know, what you defend. You know, that's how we won the American Revolution. You tire your enemy out. You wear them down, they'll sue for peace, and then, of course, you're going to avoid probably as much casualty as you can. And that was the problem. Jeff Davis never gave Lee everything he wanted.
No.
Because Lee always wanted more men. You know, like, just knockout blow. On the other hand, you know, I mean, Lee was using up men and materiel in these risky behaviors, all the Confederate loss, whereas Jeff Davis wanted to hold them back. So that was the problem here, is you've got two different visions. And so, again, I think you have to take into account some of the leadership of the Union as well as Lee's inspired moments in the war.
Let me grab one more phone call. This is Don in Rochester. Go ahead, Don.
After visiting Gettysburg, I developed a kind of a weird theory. I got the feeling that when Longstreet and then all of his generals told him not to have the battle there, I think he was sick of the war and felt it was better to have a disastrous defeat and end the war rather than continuing, because so much damage is happening in Georgia and in the other areas. That was better to get it over. And I definitely developed the feeling that with all his generals fighting, that he'd won all the other battles, but where they had the higher ground. And here's a case where he knew darn well the higher ground was on the side of the Union. And almost every battle, I don't think there were any of the battles in the Civil War where the people on the higher ground didn't win.
I think there was Lee was overconfident because they had the South had won tremendous victories prior to Gettysburg at Fredericksburg and then Chancellorsville. Mm-hmm. So I think he the odds were high and he bet. That's my thinking. You may be right to the extent that, you know, let's try and win it all.
Don't forget Cold Harbor, though.
I was just about to say the same thing.
Well,
he didn't give up. That's for darn sure.
No, he did not give up.
How about all the people he slaughtered at Cold Harbor?
And that was a slaughter.
It was a slaughter.
And again, I just, you know, not to take anything away from Omar's, but let's just put him in context, shall we? And there were a lot of other generals and a lot of other strategists and quartermasters in the South, too, right, who were supplying this army, right, that there was logistics. And I think, you know, Lee bungled.
Lee was also without some of his best generals, too. I mean, he had Longstreet, but they were also, Stonewall was gone by that point.
My right hand, he said.
There were two or three generals that were gone by that point.
Yeah.
So he was, you know, he did not have all those best players in the game.
Yeah, but the Union had, you know, Dan
Sickles.
Yeah, Sickles, exactly. Sickles. I mean, that alone, you know, that's like a handicap, right?
Lost his leg at that battle.
Yeah, well, he was took out a line on the peach horse.
Well,
so, you know, I mean, there are a lot of bungles on the Union side. So
you can see why I was so eager to have this panel. The book is called Mrs. Lee's Rose Garden, The True Story of the Founding of Arlington by Carlo DeVito. The book is out now, available where, Carlo?
Wherever books are sold, Barnes & Noble's, independent bookstores, Amazon.com. You can call my house. Heck, I'll sell you one.
Carlo is someone who's worked for years to kind of peel back interesting stories about stories we already know, but stories within the story. And Mrs. Lee's Rose Garden, that takes us into the true story of the founding of Arlington, is a remarkable piece of work. As I've said earlier this hour, as Memorial Day approaches, it gives me that greater appreciation. So, Carlo, some final words from you. Why did you want to write this story?
Well, actually, one of the other things that we were talking earlier again about what inspired me, but one of the things that's really fascinating to me is that Meigs was, as I said before, almost puritanical in his even when his son dies, he can't bring himself to write grief, and, you know, to say my poor boy or whatever. He really tries to keep a stiff upper lip through the whole thing. And yet his son's grave is possibly one of the most remarkable things you will ever see. And it is such a display of that grief and of that anger. And it is one of the most visited of all the graves in Arlington Cemetery. And it to see the likeness of his son lying dead on the ground in this beautiful bronze relief is incredibly compelling. And that is really sort of the sort of final testimony to the tragedy that is Arlington and how it came to be. And that was a very, very poignant thing for me. And that's, again, for Meigs, who is so incredibly private, to put his grief on such public display is really what it's all about.
The book is beautiful. Thanks for taking the time, Carlo. Mrs. Lee's Rose Garden is out now in time for Memorial Day to learn more of our national history. Carlo DeVito taking the time to come into Rochester and tell us all about it. Thanks, sir.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. Joseph, thank you, everybody, guys.
Yeah, Joseph Fornieri, the author of Abraham Lincoln, Philosopher, Statesman, and the director of the Center for Statesmanship, Law, and Liberty at RIT. Great conversation, Joseph.
Thank you so much.
And
pleasure.
Tim Nealon, chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Nazareth College. Always great to see you, Tim. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
And thanks for all the wonderful phone calls and comments these 2 hours on Connections today. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks for listening to member-supported public radio.